Thank you, Jimmy. He must feel pretty liberated. I see he's going all over the hymnal back and forth where he normally leads hymns. We don't have the equipment that'll accommodate that, so basically he just has to go page after page after page. So this must be a great experience. Also, there was one correction that to the announcements, and that is that this coming last day of unleavened bread, it'll be 10 o'clock, 10 and 2:30 is when the services will be. 10 and 2, 10 and 2, okay, I think it says 10:30 and 2:30 maybe, but it'll be 10 and 2 for the last day. So if you are coming and expecting it to be 10:30 and you're running late, you may be late. So that to say that, Make sure you include that in your planning. I'm going to give you the title of my message first. And that title is The Letter. Now, we'll get to that in a minute. I was recently, some time ago, not a long time ago, but a little while ago, I was going through my room. I was reorganizing and it really needed it. I call it my room. It's my slash man cave, office, whatever. And I was going through my things, and I saw something that my mom had written. And included in that was a column out of a newspaper. And this column, I thought it was pertinent for today, this column, and it must have been quite some time ago when this column was written, as we'll see in a minute here. But it was written by a fellow named Richard Lederer, and he was an English teacher in Concord, New Hampshire. And what he did was he took some of the letters or some of the reports that his children or his students had made for him or done for him, and he compiled them because they had some hilarious and funny things in them. And one of the first one, I'll read just a couple of them. One of the first ones was, it said, Pharaoh forced the Hebrew slaves to make bread without straw. I found that a little enlightening, but if you think about it, the reason I say it must have been done quite some time ago was because you don't hear God in school anymore. So this must have been a while ago when it was still legal to do so. This is titled, by the way, The View from Mount Sinai. And this is why he called it that. He said, afterwards, Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, but he died before he ever reached Canada. So, and this one here really caught my attention because I think it's pretty pertinent for today. It says, Moses led them to the Red Sea where they made unleavened bread, which is bread made without ingredients. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried that. I never have, but I am sort of, you know, would be sort of puzzled about how that's going to work. But that's the view from Mount Sinai. Now, this is not the letter that I'm talking about. As I mentioned, we're going to get to that letter in a few minutes. But for now, and I wanted to, if we were in court, this would be important. I wanted to read this into the record. After all, we're here for a reason. It's a Tuesday. When we were coming to church services this morning, there was a lot more traffic than there normally is on the Sabbath when we come because people are going to work and they're busy about their life going to and fro, and they're obviously going to work, doing things, which we're not. It's different for us. So I wanted to read this into the record as to why that is. In Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, and this we read this every year, and it's not unfamiliar to us. It's very familiar to us unless we're brand new in the church. But in Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, in verse 4, it says, these are the feasts of the Lord. They are holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their appointed time. In other words, when it's the right time, then we are to announce these or proclaim these, and we are to go forward from there. Verse 5, on the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And of course, on Sunday evening, many of us were here, or we were in some location, most of us, to partake of the Passover. And then it says in verse 6, and this is speaking about today, verse 6 says, and on the 15th day of the same month, that first month, is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation, you shall do no customary work on it. But you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation, and you shall do no customary work on it either. So, for 7 days, we're going to be eating the flat bread, as has sometimes been called the bread of affliction, the bread made with ingredients but unleavened. And that's what we have done for now, as long probably as we've been in the church, in God's church. For some of us, it's a long time. For a few of us, it's a newer thing. But when we came to the church, that's what we started doing. I want to get one more little detail, a little more detail into this in Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter. Deuteronomy 6. And we'll get this into the record as well. Deuteronomy 6. I'm sorry, let's go. I took you down a little to Deuteronomy 6 a little early. Let's go back to Exodus, the 12th chapter, my apologies. And we will start there, and we will read from 15 to 20. This is where we get a little more context in the immediate context of what was going on at that time. In verse 15, and this is right after the Passover was outlined and spoken of, it says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leaven or leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which every one must eat. In other words, the preparation of immediate food. That only may be prepared by you. So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on the same day I will have brought you, or your armies, out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. And that's, of course, why we realize and know that we are still required and still need to do that. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off. And when it says, in the Old Testament especially, when it says cut off, it doesn't just say that you're excommunicated from the community. It means that you will be eliminated physically and personally, that you will be stoned. That's what it means when it says that to be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat unleavened bread. So a little bit more of a context of why and what they were doing, what the reason was for it. But now we'll go to Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter, and we'll get into the main portion of this. Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter, and we'll begin in verse 20, and we'll read to verse 25, which is the end of the chapter. It says, you shall, when your son, in verse 20, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of this? What does this mean of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give us the land of which he swore to our fathers. In other words, the promised land. Not Canada, but the land of Canaan. And the law commanded us, and the Lord rather, commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe these commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. So when our son asks us in time to come, it says here, what does this mean? What do we tell him? It obviously we weren't there. We weren't delivered from Egypt. We weren't slaves in Egypt. So what are we going to tell him? What are we going to say? What does this mean? Well, the letter. Fortunately, I have the letter with me today. It was written to me, and it explains how to live the unleavened life. How to live your life in such a way that it's unleavened. And it explains some things about why and what we can tell our son when he asks us. But it was, as I say, it was written to me. Now, granted, it was not addressed to me, but I know it was written to me because when I started examining myself for the Passover and started to try to remove the personal leaven of sin out of my life, this letter pointed right at me. So I know that this letter was meant for me as well as those to whom it was written at the time. It's too long to read it all, but I will say this about it. It's written to me, so just lean back and relax and enjoy the ride, and I'll read the letter, portions of it, the portions that I think are the most applicable. And it reminds me a little bit of reading somebody else's mail. I don't know, probably not too many of you know what the budget is. I know there are some of you in here that do know what the budget is. The budget is an Amish newspaper that's extant in almost all the Amish communities. Wherever you would go, they know what the budget is if it's an Amish community. And what it is, it's just a bunch of columns for the most part. There's a few other things in it too. But for the most part, it's just a bunch of columns that people write, and it's like getting a letter from home. Sam Yoders came over and visited us on Sunday night. They brought their grandchildren, and we had cake and ice cream, you know, those kind of things, just little personal things. And Maddie fell and broke her leg last week, and she is not feeling so good. She's laid up and can't get around. That kind of thing. If you ever get a chance to look at it and get a copy of the budget, probably I should bring one sometime because you might find it interesting to look at. But like I say, you can just follow along and listen, because this is, after all, a letter that's written to me. It was written by a fellow by the name of Paul. And this fellow, he was a Christian man, and he seemed to know a lot about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. He seemed to know an awful lot about it. He did, as I say, he did write it to somebody, but exactly me, it wasn't addressed to. But I could tell it was for me as well. He wrote it to a group called the Corinthians. Now, these people, he lived in a town called Corinth, which is a rich and decadent town. And I did some checking, did a little research, and I think it's somewhere east of Youngstown. Okay, it's way east of Youngstown and then some. But nonetheless, it is east of Youngstown. It's not west, I don't think. But he seems to have started this group, actually. And one of the nice things about this letter, I get emails now. Most of the letters I get are in the form of email, but they apparently didn't have email when this was written. So somebody, I don't think it was Paul, but somebody took the time to, it's a long letter, so they took the time to divide this particular letter into chapters and verses, which makes it very handy for me to go through it and find what I want when I'm looking for it. So we'll go there. This letter, I'll read from the first portion of this. It's called, he actually wrote two letters to this group. And I'll go to the first portion, which is divided off into as 1 Corinthians, and I'll go to the first chapter of that particular message or letter that he wrote and see what he wanted me to know. It says, Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God and Sosthenes, which you can read also in chapter 18 of Acts, talks more about this particular fellow, a little bit more. He was a ruler of the synagogue. And Sosthenes, our brother, to the church of Corinth, of God, which is at Corinth, to those who are sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints, with all who in every place call on the name of Jesus Christ our Lord, both theirs and ours. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. I told you that this fellow was a Christian man, and it shows up right here in the beginning here of his letter. Then dropping down in the verse 10, this group that he wrote to seems to have had some issues. He says, now I plead with you, we'll read from 10 to 13, I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing and that there be no divisions among you. And when I read this letter, I thought, wow, I'm sure glad I'm not in a group that has any divisions or has no issues, because that would be uncomfortable at times. And that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together. Remember now, this is talking to me. That you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brother, by those of Chloe's house. Somebody had been tattling, apparently, had been telling him some things. So it was told him by those of Chloe's house, household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I'm of Paul or I'm of Apollos, and they were bickering about who was whom. Is Christ divided, he says? Was Paul crucified for you? And we'll find out, he mentions crucifixion here, we'll find out a little bit later that this particular letter was written during this time, this time period of life. But these issues that they had must have been severe enough that Paul decided that he was going to write them a letter and help them to get straightened out a little bit. Excuse me. Dropping down to verse 26, still in this same first chapter of the letter that he wrote. For you see your calling, brother, that not many wise men according to the flesh and not many mighty men and not many noble are called. And there, this is what nailed it down for me. I knew then that this was for me. This was to me when he said that. In verse 27, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. The unleavened bread made without ingredients, that no flesh should glory in his presence. So I can pretty much identify with that, that means me. It's just like I am. So let's go now, let's find out what this unleavened living or this unleavened life is all about. What is it that he wanted me to find out from this particular letter that he wrote that was directed at me? In chapter 5, he gets down to brass tacks. It's just a couple pages forward. And he begins to explain what this unleavened life is all about and what this leavening is all about, why they were supposed to eat unleavened bread when they came for 7 days. They were supposed to eat it when they came out of there. In the first two verses of this particular chapter 5, he gets down and he explains, he mentions one of the issues, one of the key issues, and one of the big issues that they had in this particular group, in this church. And it's an issue that needed dealt with, as we can see if we read that. But we're going to drop down into verse 6. In verse 6, he says, "Your glorying is not good," because they were glorying in the fact that they were so tolerant and they had so much forgiveness and so much love for this person who was doing some heinous sexual, or had heinous sexual immorality in his life and in the church. It spilled over into the church. So he said, "Your glorying is not good. It's not good that you take that approach to it. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore," and he uses some older type words that we probably don't use too much anymore. Words come and go in the English language and in every language probably for that matter. And this particular one is one that we don't use very often anymore. But he said in verse 7, "Therefore, purge out," in other words, clean out "the old leaven, that you may be a new lump." And as has already been explained in this area and maybe in other areas as well, the lump he's talking about is the fermented little lump of sourdough bread starter that you have to use if you don't have any yeast any leaven. Regular leaven, then you have to take a lump. And my wife has made bread like that. My aunt gave us a bread starter, and it was she used it to make sourdough bread, which is good bread. It's real good bread. But this time of year, we always have to get rid of that lump because we have to get rid of the old lump of leaven because it obviously is not a part of the items are part of the things that we can keep in the house during this particular time. So he said, "Purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened," which could mean that we're unleavened because we've been baptized and probably has that connotation, but it also means probably that they were unleavened because they had de-leavened their houses and had cleaned out their houses. "For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us." Then in verse 8, he starts to getting down to the finer details and the finer points, and he tells us some specific things that leavening is and that I need to get out of my life, that I need to get rid of. And again, when I started reading this, I realized right away that this letter was for me. "Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice." Now, surely, I've been in the church for quite a few years, and surely I don't have any malice. I'm not malicious, I don't think, or I wouldn't think so, but, you know, when I really started looking a little bit more in detail, I noticed that maybe there just was something. Because I'm only malicious if somebody deserves it. I'm not malicious naturally. Normally I'm not malicious, but, you know, there are times when people probably deserve it. And what am I to do? What's a person to do? Because if that's what's called for. So maybe there is a little ill will or some evil in my heart at times. I probably can be provoked when I think about that now, you know, as I really look at it, and if I really give it some serious thought, I probably can be provoked a little bit. So maybe he has a point here. A small point, but he has a point. So maybe that's something that, I'll consider it. We'll see. I'll try to see what I can do about it. But he didn't stop there. He kept right on going. And he said, let us keep the feast not with old leaven of malice, but also wickedness. Now, wickedness, you know, we're, again, been in the church long enough now that wickedness is not something that I look at myself and say, boy, Freeman, you're a wicked person. It just doesn't sound right to me that I would be a wicked person. But nonetheless, there may be some things. It's this particular word, when you look at it more closely, it means depravity or evil purposes and desires. That should be pretty easy. Should be easier for me to take care of that. It shouldn't be that difficult for not to be wicked, not to be evil or depraved or whatever. But what about sometimes I might have, I'll concede, a wicked desire or an evil desire or a purpose in my heart? I could have, and probably I do sometimes. I don't want to, but the same Paul said in another place that he said he tries to do the things that he knows are right, but there's something inside him, which is our human nature, there's something inside him that makes him do things that he doesn't want to do. And when I thought about it, I think, sometimes I am that same way too. So again, it points at me, and it may be something else that I should look at a little bit more closely and more carefully. But now he gets positive. Now he goes on and he says, but keep this feast with the unleavened bread of sincerity. I'm pretty sure I'm pretty much sincere. It means clearness and purity. I'm probably as pure as a new driven snow, I think. But I'm not sure everybody else thinks that all the time. But maybe I think that I could be. But surely I don't say one thing and do something else, do I? I mean, I don't promise somebody that I'll do something for them and then not do it, forget to do it. I'm getting old, after all. You know, forgetfulness is a part of being old. That's at least what I'm told and what I've heard. So, again, it's not really my fault, right? Because I'm old and I forget things, so I don't try to say things and then not do them. I try to do the right thing, and I try to not be a hypocrite and say one thing and then do something else. I try not to be hypocritical, and hypocrisy is sort of representing yourself to be one thing, and when actually you're not quite that. You're not quite all that you claim to be. And I thought about that a little bit, and maybe sometimes that can crop up in my life. So I can add that too also to the other things that I need to start working on and look at. Then he adds even another element to it in this particular verse. And he says, keep the feast with the unleavened bread of truth. Not truth, you know. It's not such a hard thing, right? Free from pretense, falsehood, or deceit. Surely I wouldn't ever try to deceive anybody. And again, it's a little bit like sincerity, where I wouldn't try to deceive somebody and try to think something is true when it really may be not quite true. Maybe it's almost true, but it just misses the mark by just a smidge, just a little tiny bit. I don't try to, unless, of course, it's inconvenient. And sometimes the truth is just plain inconvenient. If I tell the truth, if after I've done something wrong or something I shouldn't do or have done something the wrong way, it could hurt me if I, in all kinds of ways, financially, in terms of credibility, all types of ways that the truth could hurt me. So maybe I'm, you know, guilty once in a while of something like that. Try not to be, but maybe once in a while, maybe I don't tell the IRS 100% what I'm doing or what I say on the paper. But there again, there's probably room for improvement there as well. Now you think, wow, that's quite a list. But you've seen those ads on TV that say, but wait, there's more. There's more. There's quite a bit more, and we can't get into all of it, but there is more. If we move forward to chapter 10 of this letter that Paul wrote to me, chapter 10, and we'll start with a little background here in verse 1. It said, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food. Now, these are all things that are repetitious. We've probably heard these things either read or talked about or whatever several times already in the last couple of weeks. But repetition is good. I think it was Zig Ziglar that said that repetition is the mother of, I don't think I wrote it down, but it's the mother of intentions, and the father of something, and then the accomplishment of it is action, that it creates action. If we do have the intention, and then if we actually do something, if we actually go ahead and put it into place. So repetition is a good thing. You can, if you went online, you could find many places where it'll tell you what repetition will do for you. All young students, and I know we have some teachers here, and some students as well, probably. And that's the foundation of how they learn, is by repeating and repeating and repeating. Athletes are the same thing, same way. They call it muscle memory, and they have to do things over and over and over again so that they have muscle memory, so that they can repeat an action. A baseball player, for example, forget what it is now, how many thousands of at-bats they have before they can repeat their swing and that kind of thing. So athletes are also a part of this, as are musicians, because you have to learn the chords, you have to learn the notes, you have to learn all the things, and you do that by repetition. So repetition is not a bad thing. This is what we do every year. But anyway, all of these were baptized, as it said, into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. Then he starts on down, and there are a list of other things that we also, or that I also need to look at and see how I'm doing, comparing myself to those things. But he said the reason these things happened became our example, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. In other words, they happened so, or were written and happened so that we can look at them and we don't have to learn the hard way. So that I can look at this and say, you know what? Didn't work for them. It probably will not work for me. Isn't that what they say the definition of insanity is? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, this is written down so that we don't actually have to go that through there. I don't have to repeat their mistakes if I choose not to, but it takes a conscious effort on my part. In verse 7, we come to the first thing, and it is, do not become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now this is citing a particular example, and we'll turn back to there, Exodus, the 32nd chapter. Exodus 32, and we'll go from verse 1 to 6. Moses, as you might remember, had gone back up on the Mount Sinai, and he had gone up there for the purpose of talking to God. He was up there 40 days and 40 nights, and he got the Ten Commandments. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said, come make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, we don't know what's become of him. He must have got lost. He abandoned us. He deserted us. He's not around. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, well, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And they said, this is your God, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is the feast of the Lord. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play, just like my friend Paul wrote and like he said. Now, it was sort of interesting. I always found this to be a little bit humorous, actually, if it hadn't been so serious. Moses did come back down. God told him, you better get back there because they're doing some evil things, and you better get back there and straighten them out. But in verse 24, he questioned Aaron about it, and Aaron said, I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. They gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and out comes this calf. And I always thought that was funny, because I've never thrown anything in the fire that has taken any form that I would have wanted it to in the fire. It's probably like, it's about like the theory of evolution. It probably has that much chance of actually happening. And besides that, back in verse 6, it said that he had taken graving tools and had engraved and made a molded calf. But surely this is one of those things that does not affect me. Idolatry, because how could I be affected by that? Well, it said, make us gods to lead us and go before us. And I'm thinking, well, what is it that motivates me? Do I have to have the latest thing because some movie star or a baseball player or whoever it is, somebody that I sort of admire has to have that? Is that an idol, or could that be an idol to me? It probably can. It probably can be. So there again, there are things that I idolize probably that I shouldn't. And the more closely I look, the more I see. Or maybe I have the crowd mentality where if somebody else is doing it, then I just go along with it because I don't have the personal fortitude and strength to stand up personally and to stand up for what's right. Maybe I allow others to influence me unduly and follow them, which also would be idolatry that we are not to be engaged in. I tell you what, this letter is starting to make me a little bit uncomfortable because it shows that maybe I'm not quite as perfect as I maybe have had wished. I didn't actually think I was that perfect, but I wished I were. And maybe I'm not quite as good as I thought I could be or thought that I should be. So that was verse 7. Let's go to verse 8. Now this one here, nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them lost their life. And this is written about in Numbers, the 25th chapter. Numbers 25. Numbers 25, and we'll read verse 1 through 9, if I can get there. There we go. It says, now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord. So this was pretty serious. It wasn't just something that, oh, we can take it or we can leave it. It was pretty serious business. Hang them out in the sun that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men. They all were over sections, who were joined to Baal of Peor. And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. And those who died in the plague were 24,000. Now in 1 Corinthians, it had said 23,000, but I'm guessing that it might have been between 23 and 24,000 people that died for this one thing, the sin of sexual immorality. In another place, I didn't look it up, I think it's in Deuteronomy, it mentions that those who commit such things, God will vomit them out, spit them out of his mouth, that nation and those people that do that. Now, sexual immorality I'm trying not to be sexually immoral. I'm thinking, hey, this can't affect me. This doesn't apply to me. But I thought of that place in Matthew, the 24th chapter, and I believe it's in verse 12, where it says, because of iniquity or lawlessness, the love of many will wax cold. The love of many is going to grow cold because of lawlessness, because of the influence that society has on us. Our country is plagued with an epidemic of sexual immorality. It is everywhere. You can't turn on the TV and you say, well, I only watch the news. Well, the news is saturated with incidences of sexual immorality, of sexual misconduct. It's saturated with political correctness that says a man and a woman can now be married and that's perfectly okay. That says people can, they don't really need to be bothered with getting married. Why would you want to be married when you can just live together? All of those things. And if you watch the commercials that they run during the news, or any other show for that matter, even almost kids' shows, which are supposed to be less immoral and have higher standards, you will notice the same thing. I don't watch a lot of TV, but unfortunately, and this is probably one of my idolatry issues, in the fall, when football comes on, I'll start watching a little bit of TV, watch football. And because I haven't watched it for 6-8 months, it just strikes me every time how crude the commercials are and how crude everything is when you watch TV. And you know what? We are talking about things now. Individually, I'm talking about I am talking about things now that 10, 15, 20 years ago I would have been embarrassed to mention. Presidents getting involved in sexual immorality publicly that people can, for all the world to see for that matter, and our lifestyle in this country is going downhill to the point where it's almost shameful. It is shameful, as a matter of fact, how it is. And guess what? It rubs off on me, as this letter mentions. It rubs off on anybody that comes in contact with it, because it can't help but rubbing off on us, and it is leaven of sin. Whether it's cohabiting, as they call it, or whether it's homosexuality, or all the myriad of other things that are passing now for the norm and the standard. You're a prude if you don't accept the fact that people can do what they want sexually with whomever they want, when they want. So maybe when I looked at it and thought about it a little bit, maybe there are some things that I could begin to clean up my act in my life, as this letter points out. There's another thing that he goes on into in verse 9. He said, "Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also." Christ in the Old Testament? Yeah, he was in the Old Testament. It was that rock that followed them. "Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpent," or the serpents. Does that ring a bell? Do you remember anything about serpents destroying people in the Old Testament? Again, in Numbers 21, in the Old Testament, Numbers 21, one of the first five books that Moses wrote, about the history of the Israelite people as they came out of Egypt and went through the wilderness. And beginning in verse 4, it says, "Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread that you've given us.'" What was the bread they were talking about? It was the manna that God had sent down from heaven. It was the manna that God provided for them. And I understand things get old if it's repetitious, if you have the same thing constantly. But nonetheless, excuse me, he was providing for them. And what do? They see how far they can push him, testing him. "So the Lord sent fiery serpents," this is in verse 6, "so the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, 'We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he may take away the serpents from us.' So Moses prayed for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live.' So Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole, and so it was, if a serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived." Now, you know, It's interesting, and it worked. But they took that bronze serpent with them, and later on, they used it as an idol. And they eventually, one of the kings actually ground it into dust and got rid of it. But nonetheless, but I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't tempt God, whatever, test God. Sometimes maybe I do see how far, how close, testing God to see how close to the edge I can come, how close I can get without, I'm right there in the gray area to see if I can tempt or test God. And that's basically what it means, is to test God. I see maybe sometimes, and I'm sure that you can relate to my experience, maybe, that I have tested God in the past, and hopefully that's another thing that I can eliminate from my life. Another bit of leaven that I can get out of my life, as pointed out by the letter that my friend Paul wrote. Now, there's one more that we'll look at here, and that's in verse 10. And that one, he says, "Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer." And that is talked about also back in Numbers, Numbers the 14th chapter. Numbers 14, verse 27, and then 36 to 38. This is the account, and we've gone through it, you've read it, I've read it, and we've heard about it in sermons and in many occasions in many different forms. It's when they were, Moses had sent out a representative from each of the tribes to the promised land, into the land of Canaan, to go over and spy out the land to see, is this good land? Is this something we want to, that's good for us or beneficial, or that we would be happy to move into, or is it not? So they went, and of course they came back with clusters of grapes so big that two men had to carry them on a pole on their between them to get them back. They were so big. But again, they complained and they griped and whined about it. Now he says in verse 27, "How long shall I bear with," this is God speaking to Moses and Aaron, "how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make me." And they're just continual. It's like a drip, 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 it seemed like, throughout the whole experience of their wilderness journeys. Then in verse 36, he says, and here is the punishment for it. "Now the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who returned and made all the congregation," it wasn't just that they complained, but they incited everybody, the whole congregation. When they came back, all those representatives from each tribe came back, they made their whole tribe complain. And they said they made all the congregation complain against him by bringing a bad report of the land. Because they said, they had forgotten all that God had done for them, how he'd parted the Red Sea, how he'd gotten water out of the rock, how he'd done all these different kind of things. Their shoes didn't wear out and their clothes didn't wear out for all those 40 years that they were in the wilderness, and yet they're still complaining. "Those very men who brought the evil report about the land died by the plague before the Lord, except for Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh. They remained alive." They were the only two, because they didn't complain, and they said, it's nothing too hard for the Lord. This is easy. Look at all the other things he's done. And they gave a good report, says, yep, these giants that are over there, the others said, we look like grasshoppers in their sight, but they said, they're nothing for us. They're not too big for us. God will fight for us. And he would have, and he did once the time came. But they couldn't understand this. But what's that have to do with me? I'm not a complainer. At least I don't think I am. I mean, what do I have to complain about? Not unless, of course, things don't go my way. Then I might complain a little bit, but who wouldn't? Isn't that justified? Everybody complains when things don't go their way, when things are not the way they had hoped, not the way they had expected, they don't feel as good as they wish, they don't have enough money, they don't do, you know, all the things that happen to me. I am entitled to complain sometimes, right? To whine and to bring things up that, why did this happen to me? Why did this have to happen to me? Why me? Why me, Lord? Well, maybe there is. Maybe it is a little bit of an issue for me at times. Maybe I do complain sometimes, but again, justified probably. Well, maybe not. So maybe that's another thing that I should take the time to overcome. In verse 11 and in verse 12, it sort of tells me, it told me, the letter did, what this was all about and why this was written and what good it does for me. It says, now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for my admonition or instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Lest I think I have no leaven, I better get looking for it, and maybe I better eliminate some of these things that we've talked about. This unleavened lifestyle is not as easy as I thought maybe it would be when I started. And when I got baptized, and this might have happened to you as well, I figured, good, now it's all over, now I can coast and it's easy. Everything will be easy from now on. Little did I know that that's when the trouble would begin. That's when it all would start, and I would begin to be tested more than I ever was. And that's probably the way it was for most of us. Rooting these things out is going to take some time, and it's going to take some effort. Malice or ill will may be deeper than I had realized, and it may take more effort than I thought or realized to get rid of it. Wickedness or the evil desires, they're encouraged everywhere. Everybody, you owe it to yourself, after all, is what they say on TV. You owe it to yourself to do this, to do that, to enjoy this. Don't worry about it. Relax, as the bus company used to say, and leave the driving to us. That's what we're told everywhere we look. Wickedness and evil is everywhere, and we're affected by it. I'm affected by it. Hypocrisy, or sincerity, as they say here in chapter 5, the unleavened bread of sincerity, hypocrisy. It is so much easier to take the political way out. Tell them what they want to hear. Don't worry about doing anything. Just tell them what they want to hear. That's all you need to do. And they'll nod their head and say, yep, that's good, that's good, that's good, and keep voting for us. That's what happens when we practice hypocrisy. That's what happens when I practice hypocrisy. It's easier, a lot easier, to just do that than it is to tell them the real me, or show the real me truth. Deceit, deceiving, it's only for self-protection. It's only to take care of me. It's only to make sure that I don't get, you know, burnt, that I don't get into trouble, that I don't have problems and issues. Then on top of that, all of those four things, we have four more things that we read about. On top of that, you can add the leaven. I can add the leaven of idolatry. And idolatry is one of the more insidious things probably that we run into, because it's so subtle. We don't really notice it. It's not something that stands out. If I tell a lie, it can soon be exposed. But idolatry is a little harder to expose. It's very subtle, and it creeps up on you without you knowing about it. It does me. I know that. Sexual immorality it's all over. Everybody does it, so hey, what about me? Why not me? Everybody does it. Testing God, well, we learned that as kids. You know, we tried that on mom and dad. And we test them to find out how far, how long they would let us go. How much we could do and get away with. It's exactly what we did. And little babies soon learn that. They start learning that about the time they're born, almost, it seems like. And as we get older, we get more sophisticated at it. Testing God and testing others. Then complaining, that's just a natural reflex, right? But guess what? It's one of the sins of leaven that I need to work on myself to try and get this out of myself. So to conclude, there's more in this letter that I haven't read, but you can read the letter. If you don't have the letter, check with one of us and we can get you the letter. It's not that difficult. This letter helped me to understand, and it clarified the unleavened lifestyle. Is this a complete list? By no means. There's more in this letter. There's more in other letters that are in the Bible. It also pointed out how far that I have to go to reach that goal and that standard to the perfection of God, to bring every thought into captivity to Jesus Christ, to have that mind that Jesus Christ had. So as they say in letter parlance, so long for now, I've got to get cracking. I have a lot of work to do. I'm going to work on making some bread without any ingredients.